Welcome to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, leading the business conversation right here on SAFM.
Thank you very much to Kulufela for that news update. There'll be more news at 7 o'clock. It was the great American investor Peter Lynch who said that when it comes to investing, the most important organ in your body is not your brain, it is your stomach. I wonder why. I'm Jim Meyer. This is the SAFM Market Update. Let's get you up to date. Coming up on the show today, we take a look at the latest interim results released by the team at AECI Mining. We speak to the company's chief executive, or group chief executive, Alan Dixon, around that performance and get a sense of how that business is faring. Then we have a conversation with independent energy expert Tsepo Kgadima around the latest smelting business to negotiate or to look to negotiate preferential pricing agreements as they look to prevent Section 189 retrenchments from taking place. We have a conversation with the Motor Industry Staffing Association's Phakamile Hlubi-Majola, taking a look at the Auto Act and its implications on businesses and individuals. We also have a conversation with Standard Bank's Nombasa Hlathi around the China cross-border interbank payment system that has been in effect for a little over a year. We're going to be taking a look at the impact that that has had on African trade and on the movement of transactions and settlement of transactions since its introduction. We wrap up the show as we do every other Tuesday with an agri conversation. We're going to be taking a look at the latest meeting by the Minister of Transport and Transnet alongside other stakeholders regarding the port of Cape Town and how it is that we improve some of the challenges that port has been experiencing.
The day's markets. Understanding the moves and making smarter investment calls.
As always, that's where we kick off the show with a sense of market movements. I'm joined on the line by Head of Investment Research at F&B Wealth and Investments, Chantal Marks, to take a look at the market movements and see what we make of them. Chantal, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. I suppose let's start in the East. Mountain Day in Japan. The Japanese Stock Exchange closed on celebrations of the most recent holiday that they've got there, a rather bizarre one there, but nevertheless markets were in the green yesterday, I suppose in anticipation of perhaps not being able to trade today.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of the holiday is so that people can connect with nature, appreciate the blessings of the mountains and enjoy the outdoors. So looking at things that are green and the market there reacting in kind. Unfortunately, that did not spill over to our trading day today. We had a very red day today. If you look at the graph of the JSE All Share Index, it looks like a playground slide. Really, the weakness was broad-based with the exception of resources that ended more or less flat, but some real softness in the Industrial 25, which makes up a big part of our market.
Chantal, did that have anything to do with the unemployment data that came out for South Africa? Unemployment rate reaching 33.6%. Obviously, that is a serious concern, and I suppose industrial sector stocks serve as quite a significant proxy to where we stand in some sectors, at least from a business perspective. Did that weigh in on market sentiment at all, that this is potentially one of the worst unemployment readings we've seen?
Yeah, I do think that it doesn't make for great reading, and it certainly isn't an accelerant of growth expectations. But if you look at the composition of the industrials index specifically, you have very big weightings in Naspers and Prosus, and there we get a strong follow through coming from that 10 cent share price. So really largely outside of the scope of what the unemployment rate is trying to tell us. We also had weakness in other heavyweight stocks that have very little to do with South Africa, including British American Tobacco and AB InBev. And then we had a disappointing trading statement from MTN. So disappointing at first glance, but once you drill through it, it didn't look bad at all, but that the market also didn't like, and that share was down by 6% today. And we don't know if that is South Africa anymore. We suspect the headline number freaked investors out more than anything else.
Chantal, that sounds like we've got a bit of a broad-based sentiment scare at the moment, perhaps around all of the global markets, and markets might be a little more critical, or investors might be a little more critical around what is happening in the global markets. Is that the read that we're getting when we look at other markets? I mean, there's been a lot of data that's come out. We got US jobs data last week that drove the market to positive territory off the back of weaker labor numbers in the US. Is the market kind of trying to see where we find our footing as we are in the second half of the year already?
Yeah, I think because we have so much uncertainty at the moment and there's so much going on from a geopolitical and macro perspective, what really is making the difference is the stock specifics. I think it's a stock picker's market. In the US, it's easier to buy a passive index because the companies that are doing very well are extremely large. But you can see how companies, even in the South African context, are trading around results or trading updates. You get big positive reactions when the company exceeds expectations or provides a positive update, and big, big negative reactions when they don't.
Chantal, what does that then mean for, I suppose, volatility in the market with expectations now becoming that much more important a factor? We have gone through this kind of cycle before where market expectations have led to huge sell-offs, as you rightly mentioned, in stocks, but also potentially markets starting to question a lot more around, does this actually make sense? Do these numbers substantiate where we go to? The AI conversation somehow has found a resurgence in support with the numbers that have come out of the latest earnings season, suggesting that perhaps there is still more upside to that AI conversation. Are you worried at the moment about any particular sectors or any particular markets as data clearly starts to become important again?
So, I mean, to your first point, I think volatility is here to stay because there's so much riding on some of these big companies continuing to do well in the context of the world being a chaotic place right now. So I think volatility is definitely there. The question marks are going to be around who's going to be with the winners, who's going to be the losers in this specific AI race. And then I think because so much is riding on these few big stocks and so much is riding on the AI thematic, and that's really what's driven markets higher, particularly in the US and in markets like Taiwan and Korea over the last few months, you can get very, very kind of big swings during results season. I think the best path forward as an investor is to try and think about things from a very, very long-term perspective. Because if you are going to try and trade quarterly results, there's a fair chance that you are going to struggle to make alpha, to outperform the market. But if you take a very, very long-term approach and you say, well, I'm willing to hold on to this company or this sector, I want to buy a sector ETF, or this market, I want to buy a passive ETF for the next 3, 5, 10 years, then I think you will do very, very well.
Volatility certainly is here to stay. We're seeing it take many shapes and forms as we get data points coming out locally and internationally. We'll have to see if those data points continue to influence the market as much as they have been. For now, I'll leave the conversation on that note. Head of Investment Research and Content at F&B Wealth and Investments, Chantal Marx, joining us to take a look at what's been happening in the markets today and how we make sense of it.
In case you're on the highway, driving to your first big maize delivery, and something mysterious happens. You stop at the garage to scope the damage. You realize the fuel system is kinda dear my car. You panic. But then you take a deep breath. Because you know Hino Care Gap Cover is there to cover anything outside the standard 6-year warranty. From steering columns to ABS control modules, it's the unseen essential in your business. Speak to your Hino dealer. T's and C's apply. Hino. All the way.
What separates a great business from a great investment? And when does quality become too expensive? Tomorrow evening at 6:45, Sipesihle Zwane, portfolio manager at Allan Gray, joins the SFM Market Update to discuss the difference between quality and value, the characteristics that give certain companies the ability to compound value over time, and why uncertainty can create opportunities for patient long-term investors. Brought to you by Allan Gray, more than 50 years of long-term investing. Allan Gray is an authorized FSP.
SFM Market Update.
with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
AECI Limited, the mining company listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, released their financial results for the period ended 30 June 2026. There was a cash dividend that was announced and declared as part of those numbers. Headline earnings per share up a little over 8%. The interim dividend of around R1.16 per share. We're going to be taking a look at these numbers in a bit more detail with the Group Chief Executive Officer, Alan Dixon. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of their performance. Alan, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. A strong set of numbers amidst some challenging operational environments. Revenues down ever so slightly, but profits up, and that's a sign that the business is doing well despite some of the challenges it's had to contend with. What do you make of the performance of the business?
Good evening, Jimmy, and thank you very much for having me on. We think it's a good set of results. As you say, the external market has been particularly challenging. But we set out in February with three key commitments that we had made. And the first of those was to leverage the strength of our core, which is our minings and our chemical business. Second of all is to focus on business resilience, particularly relevant in this volatile environment. And thirdly was to improve our quality of earnings. And we believe that these results showed positive and demonstrable movement against all three of those targets. So we're pleased with what we've put out in this first 6 months, Jimmy.
Alan, let's take a look at some of those operational challenges from a business perspective. Revenues, as I mentioned at the start of our conversation, down around the 4% mark. But despite this, the business navigating through all the way through to being able to see a profit from continuing operations increase by about 20%. Take me through some of those external factors and how they affected your management decisions, or at least some of the strategic decisions that you had to think about.
Perfect. Thank you, Jimmy. And I think the first point just to draw out, yes, revenue as an absolute year on year is down a little touch, as you've described. But the most material portion of that reduction in revenue is actually due to the fact that we had businesses in last year's numbers that were sold and are now outside of the comparable. So if you normalize for that, in fact, revenue is slightly up on those businesses that remain within AECI. Secondly, and to pick to your point, the challenges we've had from an external point of view really relate to the supply chain. And with the geopolitical challenges that have taken place, particularly in the Middle East, what we have seen is that there has been supply chain uncertainty in terms of how we've been able to procure those raw materials, and also the absolute cost of those raw materials per ton have increased quite significantly. So what we've really focused on, if we think about that second pillar of business resilience, has been two key areas. First of all, into supply chain. And within the supply chain, we've intentionally chosen to invest into working capital on a number of strategic raw materials to make sure we have enough stock on hand to avoid any of the complexities coming out of the Middle East and to make sure we're able to service our customers. And that has really led to a little bit of a cash lockup in terms of making sure we keep that business resilience on the supply chain. And on the other side, we've also continued to invest into the assets that we have in South Africa, our manufacturing assets, is to make sure we can continue to run those uninterrupted, which we've been able to do. And that has also ensured that we have the customer service that we're after. So those have been the two key areas that we've invested into our supply chain and into our operating assets.
Alan, I want to take a look at some other strategic decisions you've made along the way as well from a business perspective. Deciding that a cash interim dividend would be part of the numbers as it was in the previous first half of the previous financial year. But more importantly, even with revenues coming down ever so slightly, gearing's come down because the business has elected to reduce net debt. That in a time where operating environments might continue to remain uncertain for the foreseeable future, the strategic thinking here looks like a prudent balance sheet approach so that you leave as much room for maneuvering. Is that how management is seeing it?
Yeah, we do see it that way, Jimmy. I think we believe that the external market is likely to remain volatile. So there's not a lot of rationale in hoping that it's going to go away too quickly. And we believe the actions that we've taken around the supply chain and the operational investment that I've just spoken about will stand us in very good stead as we move forward and to keep us resilient in terms of that. And then when we think about the dividend itself, we believe that the balance sheet strength that you've described and the fact that typically we will have a good, and we expect another good cash unwind in the second half of the year, that we will have more than enough free cash flow to not only pay this interim dividend, but also a final dividend, as well as being able to invest into our strategic and operational objectives. So our view is, yes, keep some flexibility and some powder dry in terms of the balance sheet itself, but also we have enough unwind capability that the free cash flow will support our strategic, operational, and returns to shareholders through dividends.
Alan, before I let you go, can we take a look at the chemicals business? That has been struggling, not just not from your business's perspective alone, but I'm looking at globally, the chemicals landscape. It doesn't look the way it did a couple of years ago. How are you seeing that as a risk to your business, if it is a risk? And how is it that the business is navigating that compared to perhaps the mining business that might be outperforming that at the moment?
Jimmy, if we look at the segment of chemicals, inside of that is we have an asset called Schirm Germany, and that asset had quite a challenging 6 months in which it made some operational losses, and as a result of that, we actually impaired the remaining goodwill and intellectual property that sits against that asset. And the impact of those two elements sit within the what we call the chemical segment. But if we look and we just look at that chemicals core, which is that core asset that we're talking about right back at the beginning, that business has done fairly well. In fact, EBITDA year on year is up by 14%. So when we look at our chemicals core, we believe we have a resilient business. In this most recent 6 months, we had a very good performance from our industrial chemicals. And we anticipate that that will continue through to the end of the year. So whilst it is a challenging environment, we believe we have good assets in that environment. And when we talk about prospects to the end of the year, which includes growth overall for ACI, certainly growth in that chemicals core is what we anticipate through to the end of the year. So we still believe that to be a valuable set of assets.
Well, we wish you and the team all of the very best as you go through the rest of the year. We look forward to seeing how the full year pans out for the business. For now, we'll leave the conversation on that note. AECI Limited's Group Chief Executive Officer, Alan Dixon, joining us to take a look at the first 6 months of their year, how that panned out and what it is that they're looking ahead to as they approach the next 6 months.
Did you know, soil health is about more than nutrients? It's also about the physical, biological, and chemical properties that determine what's happening below the surface. With Omnia's Nutriology model, producers get a clear picture of their soil, so every recommendation starts with better insight. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
We're not just interested in banking businesses. We're interested in building better ones. Because the true value of a bank isn't what it provides. It's what it makes possible. Simpler operations, greater adaptability, long-term resilience. Think bigger. Think NetBank Commercial Banking. See money differently. NetBank. We're licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Ferroglobe, the business that operates the more than century-old smelter in Emalahleni, Mpumalanga, has announced that that particular smelter could be closing permanently within the next couple of weeks, putting at risk 350 direct jobs if they're unable to reach an agreement on how it is that some of the input costs that affect that business are negotiated, in particular the Eskom tariff. They're sitting at about 88 cents per kilowatt hour at the moment. They're looking to get closer to the 62 cents that was recently agreed with other members of the ferrochrome industry. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with our resident energy expert, independent energy analyst Tsepo Radima. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Radima, lovely having you on the show as always. Thanks so much for taking the time. These negotiated power agreements, we've spoken about them in the past. We've spoken about how it is that they impact a company like Eskom, but it seems more and more that by the day, the smelters in South Africa are looking to get their electricity even cheaper.
Good evening, Raymond, as well as to the listeners. Yes, I think at the outset, I want to restate the fact that NPAs are by their very nature unconstitutional. Specifically, they violate Section 217 of the Constitution. And that actually, by now, Eskom should have taken all measures to ensure that they implement and institute a standardized uniform tariff throughout the country, and I compute that number to be at 87 cents per kilowatt hour. And that is really what will get this economy growing, because currently our electricity consumption per capita continues to decline. And we need it's currently sitting around 2.6 megawatt hours per, electricity consumption per capita per year. We need that number to get to 3.8. And you and I have spoken previously about the fact that now Eskom sits with surplus capacity of electricity, which it doesn't have a customer to sell to. So the closure of this smelter in Mpumalanga, eMalahleni, will only add to the woes that Eskom is currently facing. And of course, the country at large, in terms of pedestrian economic growth, GDP growth, where as well as unemployment that continues to be on the increase, and inflationary pressure that is resultant from lower industrial output and more importation of various goods and services, including the importation on a large scale that we've had Minister of Electricity pronounce just last week when he was visiting China, that he intends to bring in Chinese technology, Chinese engineering, Chinese equipment to this country to pursue the goal of reaching 100 gigawatts of electricity supply. So this is a cocktail of problems that unfortunately Eskom doesn't seem to have a handle on, when they have got all the tools in their arsenal to be able to ensure that they can win the war against deindustrialization, which has decimated this economy.
Ragadima, how do we strike that balance between enabling the economy, as you rightly mentioned, around that 87 kilowatt hour price point, or 87 cents rather, price point, versus the ongoing electricity tariff increases we've been seeing, against the fact that all of the employers, it seems as if you're employing a certain number of individuals or have electricity as a significant input, a negotiated price agreement seems to be a good way to get to a price point that you're able to work with, but not necessarily what the country works with? How do you strike that balance, and where should we be striking the conversation so that we don't lose jobs, but also so that electricity doesn't keep going up for consumers?
Well, at the outset, I'm saying that soon we will see a case before our courts whereby Eskom is held in contempt for violating Section 217 of the Constitution, as well as all other non-discriminatory provisions in the Constitution. They are unlawfully discriminating against people on the, on social class, for example, that if you are a poorer person, you can pay over 5 rand a kilowatt hour. If you are a rich multinational company, you can pay 62 cents a kilowatt hour. I mean, it's an absurdity in the extreme. But Eskom, by their own admission, they believe that they can be able to supply electricity profitably at the 68 cents price point or the 65 cents price point that they have recently pronounced in the so-called negotiated pricing agreements, which are in any event, as I say, unconstitutional. So we won't be surprised if soon there will be a class action or a course of action in our courts to declare that conduct unconstitutional and therefore stand to be reversed. But also probably it's time for a declarata that Eskom and NERSA should actually find a mechanism of bringing about a standardized uniform tariff. Now, we have worked out the numbers, analysts such as myself, and I can competently say that 87 cents a kilowatt hour, it is actually the price that is achievable and is a price that Eskom can be able to meet. But if anything, they are not, the pronouncements by companies such as Ferroglobe, PLC, and a whole host of others that are in the ferromanganese, ferrochrome smelters, and all other smelters, or the so-called energy-intensive users, if anything, they have proved is no longer now an anecdotal evidence, but it is actually empirical evidence that the so-called renewable energy is never going to be the solution when it is on grid. And it is therefore also not surprising that part of the decline or the decrease in the energy consumption per capita in this country is resultant from the great migration. We spoke about this last week, the great migration off grid using the so-called renewable energy, which in the main is solar backed up with LP gas. But on the other hand, that once you put that power on the grid, it is not usable by anybody. It is 100% redundant. For if it was indeed usable, these ferrochrome smelters would have embarked on a behind-the-meter solution, particularly because most of them, they are located on areas whereby they have got abundant land, which they could either acquire or procure, or even that belongs to them, which they could be able to use to produce electricity for behind-the-meter consumption. They have not done so on the very basis that we have analysts such as myself have made a point that intermittent energy is not appropriate when you put it either on the grid or you make it the first priority of supply for any energy-intensive user. And Eskom should actually have realized that pursuing the so-called Eskom Green, pursuing the so-called 14,000-kilometer capacity expansion, those are only going to accelerate the untimely demise of Eskom itself, because right now it continues to be in a precarious position. Right now, it's got a transmission grid that can supply 54 gigawatt, and yet the Eskom is currently supplying no more than 25 gigawatt of power. Even on the coldest day on record this year, we see that the energy consumption per capita continues to remain low and continues to be on the decrease.
We have some concerns that we need to tackle where it relates to how it is that we achieve affordable electricity pricing, especially if we're looking at South Africans and South African businesses like Ferroglobe. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to independent energy expert Tsepo Kadima for joining us to take a look at Ferroglobe's recent announcement that the elevated electricity tariffs poses a risk to the jobs and their smelters that they operate in Mpumalanga.
Sure, it's great knowing my net worth's denominated in dollars, euros, pounds, and rands. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. This is surprising my bro in the States on his birthday.
Surprise! It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get an offshore account with 4 currency options and pay no monthly maintenance fees. Search Standard Bank Private for more. Standard Bank, it can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
With a complete view of your finances, Nedbank Private brings every aspect of your financial life together to create solutions tailored to your evolving needs. From private banking and lending to long-term financial planning and wealth management, Nedbank Private supports you at every stage of your financial journey. While others see only part of you, we see all of you. See money differently. Nedbank Private. We're a licensed FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
The Administrative Adjudication of Road Traffic Offences Act that came into effect on the 1st of July this year has some serious implications for businesses, companies and the labour market if we are not careful here, especially where it relates to auto fines. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the spokesperson of the Motor Industry Staff Association, Phakamile Hlubi Majola. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Phakamile, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Let's start with a bit of context as to where we find ourselves today. The Auto Act was officially implemented on the 1st of July. It was subsequently challenged in court, but that challenge has since been withdrawn. As it stands, that means that the Auto Act is in effect and the fines around it need to be looked at more carefully. What does this mean for businesses and those that are affected by this?
Good day, and good day to your listeners, and thank you so much for having the Motor Industry Staff Association on your show. Indeed, for us as a union in the motor industry, in the retail motor industry sector, this is a very important issue. We have members, for example, who work in fleet companies. We have members who work in dealerships. We have members whose terms of employment require them to have valid driver's licenses. So the fact that this act, that the ARTO Act, has been implemented since the 1st of July makes it a very important issue for us. It's very important for our members to understand this act, to understand its application. And for us, the most important message we want to stress to our members is that if their terms of employment require them to have a valid driver's license, then they really, really have to pay careful attention to how they drive and the number of demerits that they accumulate, because if they accumulate a high number of points, they can have their license suspended, which would have a direct implication on their employment. And so that's why, as a responsible union, we have been doing a lot of communication with the media and with the public around the ARTO Act and its implications for workers and also for employers.
Pakamile, let's take a look at the workers aspect of it in a bit more detail. Obviously, some of these workers drive company cars. Some of them drive vehicles that are not in their own registered names. And we know that with the changes announced in the ARTO Act, that this does not exempt them from having fines delegated to them by their employers.
Absolutely. So whilst you are driving a company car, one of the things that is new about the ARTO Act, what it brings to this regime of infringements, is that previously what would happen is you were driving a company car, chances are if there was a fine, in some companies they would just pay the fine. Now, the ARTO Act demands that every company must nominate a driver so that those infringements can be directly apportioned or allocated to that driver. To be allocated, they will be allocated to the driver. So those are one of the things that's changing. Secondly, when it comes to employers, it is now absolutely compulsory that every single fine must be allocated to a driver. It is also important for employers to know that if a car is not roadworthy, you can actually have demerit points allocated to your company and also to the driver. And so that also puts another burden on employees, because it means now you must be not only conscious about the points that you may be sort of accumulating, but you must also be aware that if you drive out of, you know, the company with, for example, a vehicle with a cracked windshield or something that would deem it to be in some way unroadworthy, you as an individual might find yourself liable in terms of the demerit points that can be allocated to you. So it is absolutely important that both employers and employees are very vigilant and quite aware of this act and how it can affect them.
As you're saying this, Pakamile, I can't help but wonder that we also need to bear in mind that from an employer-employee relationship perspective, this doesn't just relate to the traditional companies that we know or the traditional sense of that employment relationship from a logistics and perhaps from a courier service provider. It does also mean that employees like taxi drivers as well could be considered to be employees by their employers and would be subjected to this as well. Pakamile, I want to get your thoughts on, as the ARTO Act stands at the moment, what are some of the concerns that you have as the Motor Industry Staff Association, and what do you believe needs to be done in addressing those concerns so that we have a greater clarity and understanding around the Act?
Well, look, I think there's two things. For us, first of all, we think it's important that, from our perspective, we think this act is progressive in the sense that it's a good act in that it forces all of us as motorists to take greater accountability and greater responsibility in the way that we drive, okay? At the end of the day, what do we want as a society? We want to be safer on our roads. So as MISA, we do think that this is a step in the right direction. However, it doesn't mean that the act is perfect, and it doesn't mean that problems may not arise. One of the things that has already been highlighted to us as a possible challenge can be the cloning of registration, for example. So it is possible, and we have heard instances, for example, where people say, my vehicle registration was cloned, that vehicle that you are seeing on the system, that's not my vehicle, and now a fine has been allocated towards that vehicle. Those are some of the weaknesses in the system that need to be ironed out. And once again, it does actually reinforce this message that as a motorist, you have to be very vigilant. You must be vigilant in the sense that not only do you have to take responsibility for how you drive, we have no choice but to adhere to all road safety legislation. But also, you must be vigilant in ensuring that there is no possibility that there's some vehicle out there that possibly has the same registration as yours. And if you do pick that up, that is something that you must intervene on immediately. One of the other things that we've also picked up as a challenge is that there are a lot of fake websites that are purporting to be sort of auto payment websites, where unfortunately people are sort of making payments, and those are not the right websites for them to make payments. So again, it does require us as motorists to just be aware of some of these things, aware of the scams, and to just do your due diligence in making sure that if you're going to pay a fine, double check, triple check that that fine is being paid into a legitimate website, that you're not just handing over your money to scamsters. There are actually a lot of organizations, a lot of credible, legitimate organizations. One of the ones that comes to mind is Fines for You. They are a very good organization that can help people to navigate the space. For MISA, for example, we've already appointed them to assist with our members with any issues that they might have when it comes to fines. And they are registered and they are credible, and they can assist with helping motorists to navigate the space so that they don't find themselves at a roadblock, suddenly being presented with a spreadsheet of what is owed, and they don't know what to do. You must know your rights. You must know where your power lies in respect of these types of situations so that you don't end up being scammed or you don't end up on the wrong side of the law.
The latest legislation around the road traffic offences officially in effect, and it's important to know how it is that this legislation would impact you as a motorist. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Spokesperson for the Motor Industry Staff Association, Phakamile Hlubi-Majola, joining us to take a look at the Auto Act and its potential implications.
SFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha.
This feature is brought to you by the Standard Bank Group. Back in June of 2025, Africa's largest bank by assets, the Standard Bank Group, officially obtained approval from China for the use of the cross-border interbank payment system that China has developed. Since that date, over $1.2 billion, or almost 8 billion Chinese yuan, has exchanged hands through that payment system in terms of transaction volumes. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail with the head of client solutions for international payments at Standard Bank's corporate and investment banking, Nombasa Hlathi. She joins me on the line now to see what we make of this. Nombasa, lovely having you on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. Certainly a significant milestone crossing the $1 billion threshold in terms of transactions processed following this approval. But more than that, it speaks to a deepening of relationships between the African continent and China.
Thank you. Thank you, Jimmy, for having me on the line. Absolutely incredible journey that we've been on. And I can say to you, those values indicate and demonstrate the Africa-China trade maturing. We are seeing business-seeking efficiency, cost-effectiveness, and corridor payments aligning to global patterns. And so it has indeed means that China and Africa trades are at its deepening spirit. I don't think that will be, this is just the beginning of the journey. We will see a lot more flows coming in and increases. And this is reflective of what we're seeing in our volumes as we progress this year. We've seen volume growth. We've seen the mining, the agriculture, energies and infrastructure business increasing that trade. We've seen a strengthening of Africa's financial activity as well, which makes this business significant between Africa and China, the volumes growth and Africa and China being the bridge between the biggest trades in the world, the financial economy, making it easier to just partner and do trade with Africa.
Now, Nombasa, while the approval for the cross-border interbank payment system fundamentally means then that businesses on the African continent are able to settle their transactions directly in Chinese renminbi as opposed to other international currencies, I want to look deeper into what that does for the businesses on the African continent. You touched on the fact that this allows them to be better positioned for global trade. But beyond that, I also want to take a look at how much of a strategic advantage it gives businesses that are trading with China, that are looking to access new markets, and that are looking for timely settlements of traditional payments.
Thanks for that question. The connection into China of direct into the remember settlements offers just practical commercials. This means that we've improved the efficiency of our payments, which means we've taken away the intermediary throughout our payments that we had in the past with a direct line. They're now faster settlement of those payments. We've actually also simplified cross-border transaction by reducing FX exchange risk, where currency change from multiple currency exposed to multiple currency risks and fluctuation, you have now limited and reduced those FX risks that occur in the transaction whilst it is still moving from one area to another. This then also allows the customer to then reduce its cost because you no longer have to deal with multiple currency conversion. South Africa is an approved country where you can convert from your ZAR directly to your renminbi without having to go through the dollar, which is what used to be in the past. So we now have fewer currencies in our transaction, reducing your FX risk and speeding up the time it gets to settlement. Those are the real benefits that customers are really experiencing. We've seen the fluctuations and the inconsistencies of our exchange rate, and this proposition allows for limiting the exposure and fluctuation of rates between our local entities and the renminbi. You know, it improves the certainty between pricing as well, between the corporate as well as the Chinese suppliers, enabling the supplier to be able to be more competitive and avoiding currency risk and premiums that they can settle with their suppliers in the Africa market. And we've seen transactions moving both ways. So there's beginning to be suppliers moving into the African space, being able to fund their offices, and also buyers being able to pay suppliers directly in renminbi in the shorter space of time, therefore improving their pricing certainty in their transactions. Great transparencies we've seen as well. Because we move directly, we don't have intermediary, we can see the payment going seamlessly in one direction, and transparency in both in price and visibility of the transaction during using these new SIPS rails.
Nombasa, you touched on South Africa being one of the approved countries on the African continent. I know there's at least five other countries. And you also mentioned that, of course, this is only the beginning. I want to take a look at that. Mm-hmm. I want to take a look at how these SIPS rails could potentially unlock a new future in cross-border trade and payments for the African continent, and what that future could potentially look like, not just with China, but with the broader global market.
Absolutely. So there's a stages that we've gone through as Standard Bank. So the first phase, we've been through two phases. The first phase was South Africa being given the rights to be able to be a direct participant, and that's live and well. And we've extended that now to our Africa continent and our African Stanbics, who through Standard Bank South Africa are able to process those directly. We are currently busy in a third phase, which is called renminbi clearing on behalf of the Africa market. What then that exposes us to? It allows us to grow the proposition. We can look at the liquidity of providing a renminbi liquidity in the African continent. We can look at FX and hedging for forwards and swaps for deals going forward, which means customers can take loan agreements with China with payment terms that they know what they will pay over a period of time. We can help them and support their working capitals in various markets, their lending, and begin to grow balances where we can start investments in renminbi currency. This changes the ballgame of how we used to operate as a country with another European country. In Africa, our clients can now have more value proposition. And we're not just talking corporate clients. We can talk small business, commercial business, as well as personal people having relationships with their own retailers. They, you know, buy and source funds into China. And equally from the Chinese side counterparties, we enable them to share commodities into this African market. We allow infrastructural projects that can be funded, not just waiting and sourcing your funding in Europe, in renminbi. You can then source this from an African country for the African continent. So it opens up a new web and a new possibilities of what can be done in this relationship of growing payments in the continent. And I must emphasize that the intention of this proposition is to offer an alternative. We know that we continue to have that the market is still settled on using the dollar. But with time, once you give the market an alternative, beginning to give them a space where can they try things differently and grow an alternative in the market. Freeing those markets, we know Africa has the challenges. We have countries that struggle with having dollar liquidity. How then do we solve for the African problems around the dollar liquidity? It's an alternative we provided.
Solving African problems and providing greater access to markets, that is the impact that the cross-border interbank payment system has had on the African continent following its approval by China for use by Africa's largest bank by assets, the Standard Bank Group. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Head of Client Solutions for International Payments at Standard Bank's Corporate and Investment Banking, Nombasa Hlathi, joining us to take a look at the impact that China's SIPS payment rails have had on the African continent. This feature was brought to you by the Standard Bank Group.
Look, being able to say my partner and I have traveled to 52 countries in 5 years is a great conversation starter. But that's not why I'm a client of Standard Bank Private. It's for moments like these. Babe, will you marry me?
Yes!
It's not what you do that matters, but who you do it for. Get up to 50% back in Ucount Rewards points on domestic and international flights. Search Ucount Travel Mall to find out more. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
The segment is brought to you by Omnia, your agriculture partner for more than 70 years. So about a month ago, towards the end of June, possibly the start of July, we had a conversation with the Table Grape industry looking at the challenges they've been facing with ports like the Port of Cape Town and the impact that has been having on export productivity. Just today, the minister in the Department of Transport has been engaging with Transnet and the other industry stakeholders around how it is that we address some of the bottlenecks that have been plaguing the Port of Cape Town and other ports. We're going to be taking a look at this in a bit more detail once again with the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Table Grape Industry, Misha Peterson. She joins me on the line again to take a look at this matter. Misha, lovely having you back on the show. Thanks so much for taking the time. I understand you were in the meeting with Minister Creasy and the other stakeholders, taking a look at how it is that we deal with the challenges that confront the Port of Cape Town, a port that is important to not only your association, but other exporters in the country. Tell us about that meeting and just give us a sense of what was on the agenda.
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy. Thank you. So today was an important conversation. I think it is important that we start off the departure point centered around how we better work together as role players to achieve more streamlined operations at the port and ultimately get fruit in the market in desired windows. So with that, you know, there are various engagements that happen at different levels. Today was a ministerial engagement, and I believe that's important. We had the minister with senior Transnet leadership there. And it's very good to create an understanding and also accountability at different levels. So what I can share is that there were three commitments that came from the minister's desk today. Number one, in the immediate term, we will establish a stakeholder forum with execution authority to promote integration. So this forum will be focused on the gate, the stack, and the vessel, which are three key components at the port operations. And the idea is to support agile decision making. It will comprise Transnet port terminals, shipping lines, and freight forwarders. Then in terms of season readiness, quite an important one for us in the grape context, it was agreed that there will be a strategy in place to effectively utilize the wider port networks, including those outside of Cape Town. And what that means is proactively planning to divert cargo to other ports, which helps us mitigate factors that constrain efficiency, such as weather. Thirdly, in the longer term, Transnet will have a look at their digital agenda with the aim of creating platforms that can give us greater visibility of shared data. And this is important to drive data-driven decisions across the value chain.
These sound like very important improvements and commitments that have been made here. Misha, if we are looking at these commitments and we're looking at where we currently find ourselves with the challenges that we've been looking to address, where do some of the risks still remain outside of these commitments?
Yeah, so look, there's quite a lot of plans in motion, but they will still need to be implemented operationally, and there's a way to go for that. In my opinion, some of the biggest risks that we face, especially during the deciduous season when we've got peak volumes, so unpredictable weather. I think climate change is becoming more and more evident and relevant. Second to that is labor planning, and then third, equipment reliability and breakdowns. So in terms of those risks, the port did outline plans around these today. So in terms of labor, they have something in place to avoid absenteeism that was prevalent in the previous season. And you need that because you don't want to have fewer teams than are required. So with that, they're employing more people. They shared that they have recruited and they're busy with more recruitment. And their plan is to get backup operational staff from PE and Durban to help in Cape Town. So that should make a difference. And then in terms of equipment, there's a number of things ongoing with some new equipment that has been ordered and with working with the original equipment manufacturers in terms of fixing things that need to be fixed. In terms of the unpredictable weather, that's something no one can foresee, but this is where the diversion strategy becomes extremely important, especially during the peak deciduous season. In the grape context, we saw a big increase of diversions via the Eastern Cape ports last season, and I do expect to see that again this season.
Misha, last time you and I spoke, we spoke about the fact that some of the export highly perishable products, and I want to take a look at whether or not that's been addressed. Do we have any special measures that might be considered at this stage or that have been mentioned at this stage around how we deal with those highly perishable products, especially where they might have strict international delivery deadlines? How do we deal with that? Because that could be more time sensitive than perhaps some of the other exporters, understanding, of course, that by and large, a lot of our agricultural exports are perishable in their very nature.
Yeah, Jimmy, so grapes definitely falls into that category, highly perishable. Stone fruit also falls into that category. For example, plums, extremely perishable. And I think this is where planning and streamlining operations becomes really important. Typically in port operation, there are three key areas that you need to look at. So that is the gate, the stack, and the vessel. If either one of those stop working, it causes a bottleneck or a backlog somewhere else down the line. And what you ideally want is to keep fluidity. So at the gate, what we mean is there shouldn't be long queues of trucks. Trucks that have an appointment should come in. It should be a streamlined, easy process. Offload your cargo and leave. Stacks should be loaded and offloaded, in good time so that the vessel can sail. And that's what we need to make sure that perishable products maintain the cold chain. That's key. And that the ship sails on time with all the cargo that should be packed on that ship. That is how we ensure that we keep our market windows and our commitments with our programs. So I know it's a lot of big words, but the conversations today centered around how the port can streamline their operations inside the port and how industry can support them with the parts that we manage the value chain outside of the port. And we all really need to do our bit to see an improvement this season.
It's all about working together to ensure that we are able to access these new markets and maintain our competitive advantage in these markets if we are to expand our agricultural sector into the global landscape. We'll have to leave the conversation on that note. Chief Executive Officer of the South African Table Grape Industry, Misha Peterson, joining us to take a look at the meetings held with the Department of Transport and Transnet on how it is that we improve logistical infrastructure to get agricultural exports into the world. This segment was brought to you by Omnia. Your harvest, our greatest achievement.
Did you know? A soil sample gives you a comprehensive understanding of your soil. Through soil, sap, and leaf analysis, Omnia helps turn data into practical, producer-relevant recommendations. Because when you understand your soil properly, you can make better decisions in the field. Omnia Nutriology. Better farming starts with understanding your soil.
It has gone 7 o'clock. Kulafela Tefo and the SFM News team are standing by with the latest round of evening news. From our side, good night.